I find this scientifically fascinating.
All that is visible must grow beyond us, extend into the realm of the invisible.
Thanks for joining us and welcome to Mysterious Universe, now 8th in a series of special episodes. This one features UK author David Icke. It's done by UK journalist John Smithies and was originally slated for the UK edition of the Epoch Times, but has been acquired exclusively by Mysterious Universe. Now, many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with David's writings. He's a British writer and public speaker, and he's devoted himself since 1990 to researching who and what is really controlling the world. He's published at least 20 books outlining his views, which is a mixture of New Age philosophy and apocalyptic conspiracism. American political scientist Michael Barkin, in a 2003 study of conspiracy theory subculture, writes that Icke is the most fluent of conspiracy authors, which gives his writings a clarity rarely found in the genre. His core ideas are outlined in four books written over 7 years. The first was The Robots Rebellion in 1994. Then we had And the Truth Shall Set You Free. That was in 1995. And then in 1999, he released The Biggest Secret, the book that will change the world. And in 2001, The Children of the Matrix. And the basic conspiracy theory is that the world is controlled by a network of secret societies referred to as the Brotherhood, at the apex of which stands the Illuminati or Global Elite. And the Global Elite controls the Brotherhood and the world using what Icke calls a pyramid of manipulation, consisting of sets of hierarchical structures involving banking, business, the military, education, the media, religion, drug companies, intelligence agencies, and organized crime. As I mentioned previously, this interview was slated for the Epoch Times, the UK edition. So Smithies does ask some questions which focus on China, but Icke definitely does look at a really big picture here. He talks about consciousness, the media, society, synchronicity, and a really different worldview. The interview goes for just over an hour. We'll have a quick break about halfway through. So this is John Smithies speaking to British author David Icke.
First of all, I'd like to say thanks to you, David, for giving up your time to us. You've just come back from Japan, is that right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's a pleasure. And I've got some great friends out in Japan who have told me much about the colonization of that part of the world.
Is there much support for you in Japan?
Remarkable, really, given I've only been there twice. I went there about 6 years ago, and then some books came out of mine in Japanese, and then I went back recently, and I was amazed at how they've circulated and how people are, you know, becoming extremely interested in that whole area of thought. So, yeah, it's starting to happen over there. Very soon I'll have 5 books out in Japanese, which is more than I've got in any other country in the world outside the English-speaking world, and people are beginning to understand out there, more people anyway, just how much that extraordinarily unique culture has been hijacked by what we call westernization, which is nothing more than the infiltration of global society by this network of conquest that I've been writing about all these years.
In your books, you trace the beginnings of the global elite from the area which is now called Iraq. But China has the oldest civilization on the planet. What do you think China's role is in the formation of the global elite?
Well, I've talked about how there were certain interbreeding bloodlines which go back to the ancient world, which came through to the modern world. And I have focused on the group that came out of Sumer and Babylon in what we now call Iraq and Egypt, eventually became the Roman Empire, moved up into Northern Europe through interbreeding, became the royal families and aristocracy of Europe. And then through the European colonization of the world, became the people that are now sitting at the top of global finance and politics and business and stuff all around the world. But this interbreeding went on in China as well, and if you go back far enough. But the Chinese and like the Japanese culture, they basically move forward in their own unique way. But the, shall we say, the Sumerian Babylonian group were and still are intent on taking over the planet. And we had the first attempts to infiltrate through the Jesuit organization, which is a massive part of this global secret society web that I'm exposing. And they started to try to infiltrate Japanese and Chinese society through Christianity. They went so far but didn't make great inroads. But the great time was when the West made their attempts to impose their trading system upon Japan and China. I mean, you know, for, was it a couple of hundred years, Japan basically was a closed society. But then the Americans came along and basically said, you open your society or we blow you up. A very simplistic way of putting it, but that was basically what the threat was. And then, of course, we had the Opium Wars against China. And the idea was to take over those cultures, which in themselves, just look at them, were incredibly different to what we call the Western world. And there were many things within their philosophy, their ancient knowledge of the human body and how it works. I mean, I was only 19. I'm 56 now. I was only 19 when I first had acupuncture with a guy called Professor Arthur Worsley, who learned in China and brought his knowledge back to England and basically created the network of acupuncturists that we now have. And so whether it's acupuncture or whether it's many other things, there was this terrific ancient knowledge. And one of the themes of my books is the way that whenever the colonizers, let's use the term the westernizers, because it's just the same thing, have moved into a country, no matter what it is, Africa, South America, North America, they have wanted to destroy the indigenous culture, which held the ancient knowledge that they don't want the people to know about, the knowledge of the fact that we are consciousness and we are not the physical body, the way the physical body itself operates, the nature of energy. All these things are aspects of knowledge that the westernizers don't want people to know about. So they attack the shaman, they attack the people that carried the knowledge, often verbally. And so they've now done and are doing the same in China, where they have transformed a unique society into a horrific dictatorship in which we are increasingly seeing, as we've seen in Japan, the westernization of the culture into the haves who benefit from the westernization through the ludicrous money system and Nike trainers and all this stuff, while the great swathes of the country live in abject poverty and under terrific imposition and control. And that's the story that you find with every country that these westernizers have gone into, these Sumerians have gone into. And because they went into China later than, say, Africa or elsewhere, we're now in the process of still seeing that unfold. And
is that what you'd call the role of communism? Would you say that the westernization of China is the communism in China?
You must be telepathetic, because I was just actually going to bring that up. Chairman Mao was a front man for the westernizers, for the Sumerians. And communism is just a way of forcing people into westernization, because if you look at Russia and they say it was a communist country, it just works like the West. They just call it different bloody names. Instead of the people in so-called private commerce controlling everything and taking all the financial benefits at the expense of the people, in a communist country, the people at the top of the communist party, they take all the benefits at the expense of the people. It's just the same thing. It's just a different name to give you the illusion that, you know, one's a democracy and one's communism. It's the same bloody thing, really. Just one's more obvious and in your face. But they use Chairman Mao and the communist revolution to break up that original China and to start imposing laws and suppression of this ancient knowledge. And what they've done now is gone to the next stage, which was always going to happen, where the communists become the westernization. The westernization is now becoming more and more complete. Of course, look at Japan. I was driving being driven to the airport when I left, and we stopped in Tokyo at some traffic lights, and I'm surrounded by this massive concrete blocks and skyscrapers, and in among them was this absolutely beautiful Japanese building, and I looked at it and I looked around me and I saw Seoul and the soulless in absolute incredible clarity, visual clarity. And what westernization does is it takes the soul out of a society, it takes the originality out of society, and it imposes a all-encompassing uniformity. And I remember a couple of three times in Japan being on the top of a high building, looking out across Tokyo, and it was extraordinary. Literally in every direction, as far as the eye could see, was just concrete blocks. Nothing that said to me, this is unique Japan. They're doing the same with China now. It's all coldly calculated. That's the point. It's not by accident. It's not by all organic kind of growth. It's by cold calculated design.
You talk about the major religions being constructed to control human beings. What are your thoughts on Eastern religions such as Buddhism and Taoism?
Well, I think they're much closer to the reality of life, which is that we're all one consciousness experiencing itself subjectively. That there's no such thing as death, life is just a dream, and we are the imagination of ourselves, to quote a wonderful American thinker and comedian called Bill Hicks. They are much closer to that. But anything that calls itself something, and I don't understand why people do that to an extent, has to be very, very careful that that name does not become like a circle of wagons. And that within it, laws and regulations and musts and mustn't start developing from naming a belief. But certainly they are much closer to my philosophy. I mean, I look at life in my own unique way, but they're much closer to my philosophy than what you might call the Western religions. Because the Western religions, and incidentally, when you get to Hinduism and all that stuff, you know, and that whole idea of the caste system and all that stuff. Well, that ain't very enlightened for me. I mean, I think that is unbelievable in it, in the sense that the idea is that your place in society and what you can do and can't do is decided by the family you are born into. I mean, I think that takes unenlightenment to new depths of horror for me, and ignorance. But in general, the philosophy about energy and consciousness is very close to what I think myself. But when you look at the Western religions, they are, my father used to call them bricks and mortar religions, which I think was quite a good term. They are there to suppress knowledge of energy and consciousness and the nature of reality. And they have not just circled wagons around their beliefs, they have built whole concrete walls. And if you step out of that wall, then you are no longer a Christian, you're no longer a true Jew, you're no longer a true Muslim. And they are not religions of enlightenment, they are religions of imposing a belief system. And every dictatorship wants to control the belief of the people they wish to control. So through the extreme expressions of Islam, for instance, I mean, I spent 2 or 3 months once back in the 70s in Saudi Arabia working with their soccer team. And the staggering level of imposition of belief and behavior by these religious freaking bigots just beggars belief. They are nothing to do with enlightenment. They're nothing to do with the divine. They are about fascist imposition of a belief system to control the people, which incidentally, none of the, or virtually none of the Saudi Arabian royal family follow them bloody selves. And so religion and spirituality are not the same thing. Science, mainstream science, and real open-minded, open-hearted, conscious science are not the same thing. But real open-minded, conscious science and spirituality are the same thing. And what's wonderful today is that cutting-edge science, cutting-heart science, is speaking in its own way the same language as the shaman and the mystics and the carriers of the knowledge over centuries and thousands of years. The reason that people think that religion and science are opposites is because religion is not spirituality and science ain't science. That's why they appear to be opposites, because they're two religions, funnily enough. There's a guy at Oxford University called Professor Richard Dawkins, who's constantly condemning religions as ludicrous and all the rest of it, but he doesn't realize that he himself is an evangelist for the religion of scientism, which is to deny the divine and to deny the infinite nature of consciousness. So, you know, it's amazing how... I guess what I would say is the Western religions are head religions. And the further east you go, you tend to find the religions are more heart religions when they are expressed in their true form. Because there are many times I've come across expressions of Eastern religions who are actually expressing it through the head, not the heart, and destroying the very basis of what it stands for.
There's a Canadian human rights lawyer called David Matas and an ex-politician called David Kilgore, both Canadians, and they've made allegations that Falun Gong practitioners in China are having their organs forcibly removed for sale. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I was near the Houses of Parliament, in fact, Downing Street, maybe 2 or 3 years ago when I was filming, and there was a Falun Gong protest on the other side of the road. And I went across and talked to them and saw their placards and information. And let's say I'm convinced, because what westernization does in the extreme sense, and by the extreme sense I mean the network of families that are behind westernization, that are behind the gathering global tyranny. They do not have a key human and consciousness trait that is essential to harmony, and that is empathy. When you have empathy with the consequences for others of your actions, or you have empathy with how they will feel, that immediately has an effect on your actions. You won't harm a child, not least because you can empathize with the suffering of the child if you do certain things. The key thing, I think, for people to appreciate about those that are manipulating not just British society, but global society, and certainly Chinese society, is that they are of a level of consciousness that does not have empathy. They do not have any emotional consequence by seeing the effect on others of their actions. Now, if we just take a breath and think about that, that means there are no limits on these people for the actions that they will take. So you or me, the very thought of taking someone's organs in the way that you described would just fill us with horror. But to the people doing it, it's matter of fact. It is of no emotional consequence to them. And I've said to people many times, if you see or judge what others will do on the basis of what you will do, then you've lost the plot, because the people doing it do not have the same emotional state that the rest of us do, unfortunately.
Your work takes you around the world in speaking tours. What impact does this have on your family?
Well, I live alone now. But my family support me. There's two of my family work to keep the books in circulation. My former wife of 29 years, she runs the whole operation just 5 minutes from here. I decided a long time ago, when I started to realize what was happening, that there was nothing for me to do with my life other than try to alert people to what was going on, and also alert people to the way that their sense of who they are and their sense of reality and the sense of what the world is they live in has been distorted, manipulated, and sold to them as a fake persona and a fake reality. And so I get up every morning and I go to bed every night, and between the two, I focus almost the entire time on doing what I do. My family kind of support me in this and all the rest of it. But to be honest, if they didn't, and if no one else did, I would still do it. And I'd still do it with the passion that I do it. As Gandhi said, even if you're in a minority of one, the truth is still the truth. But the great thing is that I'm not in a minority of one. What's happened is that the manipulators have hijacked the mainstream of public awareness and public information. And there are people all over the world that basically think and see reality in the same way, who have no idea that there are others all over the world that see reality in the same way. So they think, I'm different, I'm odd, I must have got it wrong, I must be crazy. And what I'm trying to do, and what I am doing, I've had a lot of success in doing it, is to be a voice there that says, hey, you're not alone. You know, you're not alone. And if I've had a reaction more than any other over the years, it's thank goodness I realized I wasn't crazy. There are other people that think like me. And it's kind of an antidote to divide and rule. And it's having an effect without any doubt. I mean, I was talking to a man and a dog when I started out.
What do you think the impact of your work is, especially now?
Information. You see, the world population is in a hypnotic trance. This is the thing. Our consciousness experiencing it in this reality for a short time through this, what I call this body computer. And the computer can think for itself up to a point. It's not like a computer that just takes in data and then reacts to order. It has the ability to assess information and react on the basis of that assessment. That's what things like the immune system are doing all the time. And if our consciousness goes to sleep or cannot get enough impact on the computer, then basically the computer runs itself. And I see so many people in what I call computer mode, where you can predict what they're going to do just as much as you can type data into a computer and press enter. You know what the computer's going to do. You can do that with people. We are programmable until we become much more conscious than we are. When we are in what I call just body consciousness, we are extremely programmable because this is a computer. And people don't realize that the five senses are just sending information to the brain, which then decodes that information. And so if you are in a hypnotic stage show, I've seen people eating potatoes, for instance, and thinking they were apples. I've seen people who thought there was an elephant in the audience. Why? Because the hypnotist implants into the brain, if you like, the lower mind stroke brain, a belief in reality. And that's the same principle as in China, where they firewall off most of the internet so that people there cannot access it. What the hypnotist is doing is basically imposing a interrupting the normal decoding mechanism of the brain. So with the example of the potato and the apple, the electrical signal carrying the taste of the potato it goes to the brain as normal, but it decodes it differently because of the implanted belief that the guy's eaten an apple. And this basic principle is used on us all the time, not least through the greatest hypnotist known to humanity at this time, the television, which is telling us constantly what to believe is real, what to believe in terms of who we are, what to believe is success, what to believe life is about. And if we then go through an education system, which is nothing more than indoctrinating children with the official version of reality, then by the time we become adults, we can become, if we are not holding our consciousness, we can become only body conscious, and we can become programmed in the way that we see the world. We can become hypnotized, like stooges on the stage of a hypnotist. What information does is it basically reminds people of facts they already know and realities they already know, but the hypnosis has made them forget, i.e. we are all infinite consciousness. And it triggers them to start to wake up. It's like whispering in their ear, wake up, wake up, wake up. Your infinite consciousness, remember, remember. And it can have a very powerful effect on people, where people wake up real fast and go, whoa, I why didn't I see it before? Because you just woke up from the trance. And it's a very, information is a very, very powerful thing for changing people's sense of reality. And that's what I'm trying to do, get it into places it wasn't getting before.
Do you think people can change the course of this global conspiracy if they do wake up, as you say?
Oh, yes. Einstein had a wonderful phrase. It's been quoted using different ways, but basically it says this: you cannot solve problems with the same level of consciousness that created them. Now, what we're living in is a world that is controlled by the intellect, which is a very low level of consciousness. The intellect operates through the left brain overwhelmingly, and it's about language, it's about seeing the world in parts, it's about looking at the complexity and delving into the complexity, and it's about, can I see it, touch it, taste it, smell it, therefore it must exist. Anything outside that, well, I can't see it, touch it, taste it, etc., so therefore I'm not accepting it exists. And you can't prove to me that it exists. And if you look at the system that brings the people into the positions of power in the institutions of countries and the world, it is an education system which rewards those that are good at taking in information into the left brain, the intellect, holding it, and then spewing it back out on an exam paper in the way the system wants it reported back to them. If you do that well, then you get to university. If you do it brilliantly well, then you get to an elite university like an Oxford, a Cambridge, a Yale, or a Harvard. And those people then go into the next stage after they leave education or indoctrination. And they then go into their specialization, which is more exams and more left brain intellect. And what I'm saying to you in simple terms is that this system means that those who are imprisoned by the intellect, that are imprisoned by the left brain, they're the ones that enter the positions of power in the world that then orchestrates and administer and direct society. Now, you look around society, and we are living in a reality created by the intellect. And the intellect, I'm not knocking it, because it has a part to play. It is the last level of stepping down consciousness into this reality. So it does it through words and being able to express itself in the way that we communicate, and to understand things in the way that they manifest in what we call the three-dimensional world. And that's a good thing, because you can then take these big concepts of higher consciousness, and you can bring it down through the intellect, and you can express it to people in ways that they're going to understand, that relate to their everyday lives. However, if the intellect becomes isolated from higher consciousness and starts to operate basically in isolation, then it becomes extraordinarily ignorant and can become a monster, because it sees everything in terms of division and apartness. It cannot make the connections and see the oneness of everything. It cannot get its head around the way that everything is one. And I was talking to Oxford University just a few days ago, and I saw the intellect and the way it reacts with information about the nature of reality and the illusory nature of reality. And I started off my talk by explaining the structure of how a few can control the world, how it's possible through the way they've structured society for a few to control the many. And then I went on to talk about the illusory nature of reality and how that is fundamental to understand, to know why they structure society as they do, to get the to close us down in terms of consciousness. And there was one guy afterwards, he said, he was an intellectual, and he said, I got the stuff that he was saying about the structure of how they can do it, he said, but when he got into the nature of reality, he said, I'm completely lost. Why? The first part, structure, left brain, intellect. Second part, consciousness, right brain and beyond. Couldn't get it, because he's stuck in his intellect. And so what they've done with society, and when I'm talking about the intellect, I'm not just talking about the people that run science. Again, scientists, they are prisoners of the intellect, and therefore they cannot see the connections to everything. They only see the world as parts. You get cutting-edge scientists, whole-brained scientists, who are balancing intellect with consciousness, higher consciousness, and they're the ones at the cutting edge of quantum physics are saying, hey, everything's one. right? Because they can get it because they're not just imprisoned by the intellect. But when I talk about intellect, I'm not just talking about, you know, scientists and you know, these people who are ooh, go, he's clever. Cleverness and wisdom are not the same thing, incidentally. It's another thing we've lost. I'm talking about the mass of the population are imprisoned by intellect, the left brain. Maybe, you know, they can't explain the theory of atomic weaponry. Maybe they can't, you know, put a rocket together, but they're still seeing the world from a point of view of the left brain intellect, even though it's maybe not as advanced as the scientists and all the rest of it. And they're still seeing the world as a place of a partness and division. They're still seeing them as completely unconnected from everybody else. They're seeing themselves as completely unconnected from a tree or a blade of grass or a breath of air, when we are actually all one. And so what if you look at my books and you look at my talks, what I'm doing is talking to the intellect to quite a large extent, because I've noticed that if you can make enough sense intellectually, there comes a point where I feel it all the time, where the energy changes in the room or the theater or whatever. There comes a point where the left brain has become convinced enough intellectually to get the hell out of the way. It's like I see that, what are they, corpus callosum, they call it, that bridge between the two hemispheres of the brain. I see symbolically guards standing there on the door to the right brain, going, convince me then. That's what scientists are saying, prove it to me. And if you can make enough sense intellectually, there comes a point where those guards say, all right then, I'm convinced, pass on your way, and you get in the right brain. And then suddenly, bang, people start to get things on a big picture level, that if you'd have started out with the big picture, the intellect would have said, this is nonsense. So I have, from my own experience over the years, not just Oxford University, but over 20 years, seen how an isolated intellect, whether it's a high-level one or a less low-level one, is the prison that enslaves this reality, because it enslaves our perception of this reality. And breaking out of that prison is absolutely essential. And to do that, blank sheet of paper, the philosophy of Socrates, the ancient Greek philosopher, wisdom is knowing how little we know, okay? And just look at it dispassionately and ask yourself, not what do I think about it, but what do I feel about it? Because there are two distinct levels or ways of seeing reality. That's through the head, the intellect, apartness, division, or through the heart, which is oneness, unity, balance, harmony. And we have we are living in a world which was created by head. To change it, we need to change it through the heart. And if we think we're going to change it through the head, then we are going to prove Einstein right. You cannot solve problems with the same level of consciousness that created them. The reason we have problems, and then people say, vote for me, I'll solve your problem, and they get into office and the problems get worse, is because they've swapped the same level of consciousness for another under a different name. We have to have a consciousness shift, or nothing's going to change. Let's face it, it ain't.
You're listening to UK journalist John Smithies speaking with David Icke on the Mysterious Universe podcast. We'll be right back with more after this quick music break.
you were on, you recently went back on Wogan and did another interview with him, and you were also on in a Channel 5 documentary at the end of 2006. I noticed in both of those interviews the reptilian aspect of your theories was played down, yet it is a cornerstone of your ideas. Do you consciously underplay this aspect in order to appeal to a wider audience, which connects back in with what you're saying about the intellect and feeding the intellect?
Well, yes and no. I tell you why I don't talk about it. It's because there are so many dots to connect. There's so much information to present and connect before the apparently ludicrous starts to make logical sense. That the mainstream media will never, ever give you enough time to make those connections. So what I do with that whole reptilian side of my work is I'll talk about it in my own public presentations where I can give it as much time as I decide to give it. I write about it extensively in my books for the same reason. But in the mainstream, I will not talk about it because I know that it's going to be reported in the same way. Oh, it says giant space lizards run the world. And, so...
What do you think that the mainstream media perception is of you?
Well, they I'll ask you a question, which answers your question. What level of consciousness controls the mainstream media? The intellect... and sometimes a very, very, very low level of intellect. And therefore, apart from the odd journalist who is more whole-brained, if you like, and multi-level consciousness, not just intellectually conscious, then they're just not going to see it. They're not going to get it. I mean, it's extraordinary that you can talk to a lady with no formal education and all the rest of it, and she gets it. And can see it and can feel it, and then you talk to a journalist or an intellectual from Oxford University and they look at you as if you've just walked off a spaceship, because they can't get it, because they're not accessing those levels of consciousness that can get it. So of course an intellect controlled media is going to see me as crazy, insane, dotty, I think that's the word I use, and all the rest of it. So, but you have to accept that. But I have learned one great thing over the years. People can't unhear something. And the reason that enormous numbers of people are now turning to my work, overwhelmingly the reason, is because things I wrote about in my books years ago are now happening. That's the key reason. And if I had not said and wrote what I did, despite the ridicule and the hostility, then they'd have never read it, and they'd have never then seen that it's happening now. So we wouldn't be any further along the road. And when you are someone who is challenging the status quo in a world where the status quo is not to be challenged, then don't expect that people are going to, you know, pat you on the back and say what a wonderful person you are. You've got to accept you're going to get ridiculed, you're going to get condemned, you're going to get massively misrepresented, and you just have to accept that that's it. And if you don't like it, well, you know, go and do something else, because this is what happens when you do what that you do. And you know,
so is there any media that we can trust?
Well, you can trust. It's like everything else. Where are the people coming from? What's the point from which they're observing reality from? So that says, can you trust anything in the mainstream media? Well, you can trust one or two journalists within the mainstream media, but the mainstream media as a whole, absolutely you can't, because it's structured to tell us lies. And that's not in a way that every journalist is in on the plot. But if you look at the media, what does it do? It takes the status quo, the norms in society at any point, to be the point from which it reports the world. And anyone who is outside of those norms or challenging those norms is by definition mad or bad. If we'd have had today's media a few centuries ago, they would have ridiculed and condemned, in the way they have me, anyone who said the earth was round. Because the norm status quo of intellectual society was that it was flat. And then when the norm changed, anyone now who says the earth is flat gets the same treatment the round earthers would have got in originally. So the media is simply takes the norms as a point of observation. And so if you're outside the norms, don't expect the media to be fair to you. But there are people in the on the internet who I don't agree with everything they say, but they are coming from a place of truth. Not necessarily they get every fact right. I mean, how many of us get every fact right when we're trying to uncover something that doesn't want to be uncovered? But it's where are the people coming from? And I can honestly say that I have never said anything I didn't believe to be true. That doesn't mean that I've got every fact and every dotted I and every cross T right, but I've never said anything I didn't believe to be true. Now, if anyone coming from that perspective, not every last thing they say is going to be 100% accurate, but you know that you can trust the vast majority of what they're saying, and certainly the themes of what they're saying, are coming from a place of they believe it.
So why do you think people don't trust you then?
Well, people don't trust people. Well, let's put it this way. Enormous numbers of people do trust me. But people are distrustful of anyone who is saying something that is different from the norm. By definition, it's different. So, this man's strange. And with strange comes a sense of trustworthiness. So you're always going to have that too, and you just have to accept it. And I would make this point, it's really, really important, is that I am not trying to get anyone to believe anything. That's the point. Because the world is awash with people who are telling others what they should believe and how they're wrong if they don't. I'm not doing that. Not only am I not worried about what people think of what I say and do, it's none of my business. This is one point that people miss. It's my business to say what I believe to be right and to write what I believe to be right. It's not my business what people make of it. That's their business and should always be their business. And we have to respect every individual's right to come to their own conclusion about life, themselves, and reality. All you can do is say, well, here's some information that you won't have heard before because it's not allowed in the mainstream. Make of it what you will. And to be honest, if, you know, the last 20 years has been a real emotional onslaught for me, not least through frustration and what have you. But if I was attached to how people accepted my information, I wouldn't be here now. I'd be dead. You know, the emotion would have killed me. So I'm not attached to how people receive my information. What I'm attached to is the passionate belief that people have a right to hear all information and not just that which the establishment decide they're going to hear and not hear.
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your working methods. I know that you've mentioned you have a great belief in synchronicity, but where do your theories come from?
Hard research. I mean, I'm a journalist, really, at the intellectual level of this, uncovering the history, background, and methods of operation of this whole network of global control. I'm a journalist, but I'm different to other journalists. I don't have an editor. I don't have anyone looking over my shoulder telling me what I can and cannot write, which allows me to follow the information and not edit the information on the basis of either what I think people will think of me if I say this, or on the basis of I better not put this in because the proprietor or the editor won't like it. So on that level, I'm a journalist. I've been to about 45 countries researching this. I've talked to thousands of people. And for instance, the whole reptilian thing, I didn't sort of sit in a darkened room and come to these conclusions. I just kept meeting people all over the world who'd had experience of it. That's where it came from. And when I first heard it, of course, you think, my God, what's going on here? What's all this about? But when you have met so many people in so many different countries from so many different walks of life, this is where the synchronicity comes in, who are telling you the same thing and the same experiences, well, then you start to say, well, either I'm going to shut this off because I know what the reaction of people will be if I say it, or this deserves to be talked about because this is now, you know, there's just too many bloody coincidences here, too many common themes. So that's the way I operate. And I just follow my heart, my intuition. And sometimes my head is telling me, no, you don't want to do that today. You don't want to go there. Oh, what are you going there for? Or used to anyway. It doesn't so much now. But my heart says, I want to go there. My intuition says, go there. And I go there. And that's what where synchronicity comes from. Again, we're back to the same theme again. The intellect or higher consciousness, the head or the heart, because the intellect sees things as apart and divided from each other, synchronicity is the connection of things, right? So it can have a problem with synchronicity. And so when you have an intuitive feeling to be somewhere, to go somewhere, then the head can start listing all the reasons why you shouldn't go. Oh, you don't want to go there today. Look at the weather. Oh, this, blah, blah, blah. And the heart, go, I want to go, I want to go. And when you go, something happens that takes you further along the journey, which wouldn't have happened if you'd listened to the head and stayed at home. And so the great change in my life came in about 1989, 1990, when I decided that when my head and my heart were in conflict over a action, then I would go with my heart and, you know, take the consequences. And what I found was very interesting, because when you go with your heart, you're going with a level of consciousness that is beyond the intellect, and the intellect is what controls this reality and through which most people perceive this reality. So when you go with your heart, you immediately start beating to a different drum. You immediately start acting in ways that are different to mainstream society. And of course, you're going to get reactions from that from mainstream society. They're going to, look at me, they're going to call you crazy. They're going to call you insane and nutty and all the rest of it. And when people, start to receive not perhaps the extreme level of reaction that I got, because I did it publicly, but in their own lives, when they start to get adverse reaction from following their heart because of what they do and where it takes them, a lot of people then pull back from the heart and go to their head because they think it's easier that way. But if you stick with it and you keep following your intuition, even when your head intellect's going, see, told you what would happen if you did this. If you keep with it, eventually amazing things start to happen. And you look back and you think, well, not only have these happened, they've happened because I went with my intuition. And what happens eventually is what I found in my life is the intellect starts observing this, and it starts to see that although when you follow your intuition, you follow your heart, you might get into some scrapes and some challenges, eventually it all works out, not despite following your intuition, but because of it. And what happens then is your head and your heart start to sync. And you start to think and feel the same things. And so today, it's very rare that it's almost non-existent today that my heart, my intuition will say, I need to do this, and my head will say, you can't, or why I shouldn't. It's almost non-existent. The two go together. they're mates rather than at war with each other, as they are in most people, and they were in me before this all started.
Obviously, we've got the US election and the Democrat race going on at the moment. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a classic example of everything I've been writing about for a long time. We have two versions of reality going on simultaneously. There's what I call the movie version. That's the one you get through the television news and through the newspapers and the mainstream media and mainstream politics, etc. And that one tells you that there are different political parties and they have different philosophies and they are seeking a different outcome, and that you have a choice between these different philosophies and different potential outcomes. Well, that might be true in the lower levels of the pyramids of these political parties, where the activists generally and genuinely think they are different from the other party and sometimes are in their philosophy. But when you get to the real controlling levels of these parties, they're controlled by the same force. It's a simple thing. If you want to know the outcome of a football match, you want to know the score before they kick off, then it's no good controlling one side. You will influence the match, but you won't control the outcome. You won't know the score before it starts. You've got to control both sides to know that. And this is what happens in politics. They control both sides in elections. And indeed, in terms of the Democrats here, they control both of the candidates, Clinton and Obama. So whoever wins the election in what, later this year, isn't it now, will be a front person for this network that I'm talking about. If you look at the background of Hillary Clinton, Clintons in general, Bill as well, I've written extensively about this. If people knew what the Clintons had been involved in, they would not be in the White House. They would be in jail, and someone would be dropping the key mid-Atlantic. In fact, they'd have to reincarnate many times to complete the sentence. Same with the Bush family. But then someone like Obama comes along, Barack Obama, and he's the kind of good guy, kind of, he's the fresh face. He stands for change. Now, when Bill Clinton won the election in 1992, he had one key theme. He banged out over and over, change. The courage to change. Change. Why? Because at any point, because of the way the system is, most people ain't happy with their lot. So change is always a good idea because they don't like what it is, so let's have change. Yeah, we need change. But Barack Obama's never said what that change is. He just keeps talking about change. He's starting to get found out a bit as we speak, as people are starting to say, hey, Barack, what's this change actually mean? What are you talking about? And there doesn't seem to be any reply. When you look at the background to Barack Obama, his national or his foreign policy advisor is a guy called Zbigniew Brzezinski, who about 2 years ago came out publicly and admitted that he, when he was national security advisor to Jimmy Carter, had worked to manipulate the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan, which cost millions and millions of lives for no other reason than to weaken the other superpower. And from, of course, as the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan, so the American administration through the CIA and also the British administration and British intelligence and the SAS and everything, what they did was to train tens of thousands of what they call mujahideen to make life difficult for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan and weaken the superpower. That's what it was. It wasn't about Afghanistan. It was about the political agenda. And out of that came the infamous Osama bin Laden, who was brought out of Saudi Arabia to be the front man for the mujahideen. And then, you know, the rest is kind of history. Although, you know, the whole 9/11 thing is a nonsense in current terms of he was responsible. But here we have, therefore, a man who is foreign policy advisor to Barack Obama, who has admitted all that horror that he was involved in, and he's representing a candidate who is says he's against war. He's not against war at all. And he's not there to promote the interests of black Americans. He's there to promote the interests of those that control him. So whether Clinton gets in, or whether Obama gets in, or whether McCain gets in, another, you know, placeman, it doesn't matter, because as they say in America, those that understand, it doesn't matter who you vote for, the government still gets in. The secret government still gets in. Because, you know, if you think about it, politicians come and go, administrators come and go, both in local government, national government, everywhere. But the government still goes on, because the government is itself a vibrational entity. It is a kind of consciousness construct, and it's vibrating to a certain state of being. And so when you enter that construct, you might enter it with a genuine desire to bring about positive change. But how many times have you seen politicians in this country and every country who enter as young people, and they're all the idealists, and then you watch them turn into absolute clones of everything they went into politics to oppose? Why? Because the vibrational construct has vibrated them into line. It's what they call sympathetic resonance, where you put two violins down, pluck to a certain note, put another violin in there, it will start vibrating to the same note. That's what people don't realize about these institutions of politics and finance and military and everything. They are themselves vibrational constructs. They are entities in themselves. When you enter the entity, unless you hold your own vibrational state by holding your own your values and not compromising them, then it will vibrate you into line. And but by the time you run for president, with any chance of winning, because you need cuckoo lands amounts of money to run for president, and only those chosen ones attract that money, by the time you get to that level, you've already been vibrated into line. And Barack Obama is a fake, and he will be seen as a fake. In fact, it's the mutterings are already happening.
What do you think would happen to humanity should the prison planet that you talk about not succeed?
Whatever humanity wants to happen. You see, I was told years and years ago, when I first started to wake up to this, by a number of different psychic people who I just synchronistically bumped into. And there was one of the themes that they kept telling me all those years ago. I mean, I don't meet many psychics now. I haven't for a long time, but in those early days I did. Maybe because I've woken up enough to get it direct, I don't know. But anyway, that's the way it is. And one of the themes was that there was going to be a spiritual revolution in my lifetime, brought about by a vibrational change that was unfolding. And I have seen it, I have to say. I have seen it, and it's gathering. When I first started talking about this stuff, no one wanted to know. And now, 20 years later, my goodness me, the number of minds that are opening is just fantastic compared with what was before. And it's exponential. You know, it's the curve is going skyward. And I know this because I've been a barometer for it, doing what I've done through these last two decades. And so we are entering a time where the immovable object, what thinks it's a movable object, the conspiracy for an Orwellian global state, is meeting the irresistible force, which is irresistible, which is the consciousness shift that's taking place. And we're moving to a point where more and more people are entering that point where they are no longer trying to solve problems with the same level of consciousness that created them. And so we have the potential, because everything's potential. And it's a choice. We can go that way, we can go that way. We could have had an argument today. We had a harmonious discussion. It was a choice. And we always have choice. People say, I had no choice. We all have choice. There are choices we'd rather make and choices we'd rather not make in the moment, but we always have choice. And so we're at the point now where we have a choice, that if we go with this change that's going on, And we move from the head to the heart, not so that the head's just ignored, but so it's in its place and not in the driving seat constantly. We have an opportunity to change the prison to a paradise, because a paradise is just a different level of consciousness than a prison. That's all it is. And if we move to that level of consciousness, we by definition move to paradise. If we define paradise as peace and harmony and respect and empathy and all these things that stop conflict and suffering happening.
Do you see yourself as a leader, a figurehead of this movement?
No. The level of consciousness that we are moving into or having the opportunity to move into doesn't do leaders. It doesn't do leaders. It's consciousness that understands that we're all one, but that we can all express our uniqueness within that oneness in our own way. And once you enter that level of consciousness that I'm talking about, you don't need anyone to lead you, because that consciousness does it. That consciousness, when you tap into it, guides you to the best place for you to be to achieve the intent that you've decided to go with. And so leaders become redundant. We stop talking about hierarchies and we start talking about circles, where people sit in circles and look each other in the eye instead of standing on pyramids looking up and down at each other. That's what the intellect does, because it loves structure. It has to have structure and form. Otherwise, it's very, very ill at ease. Whereas higher consciousness doesn't do structure and form. It just is. And leaders become redundant once structure and form become redundant. So if I said to you, yes, I'm a leader of this movement, then I would be the last one that should be considered to be a leader of this movement, because I would have completely misunderstood what this is. It's not even a movement. That's another intellectual concept. It is a consciousness shift. And that's what's going to change, because the reality we perceive is the manifestation of the state of consciousness that both created it and is perceiving it, and the two are one, observer and observed. We move to a higher level of consciousness, we naturally change how that consciousness manifests as physical experience. Prison, paradise, it's just a consciousness shift, that's all it is, and we can all go with it. It's just a choice. And it's not even a choice to go with it. It's a choice not to go with it. That's what the intellect is trying to make us do. It's trying to make us choose not to go with it by listing all the reasons why we shouldn't. When the intellect gets out of the way, we go with it. I use this analogy many times, and it's so indicative of what I'm saying here. Our natural state is multidimensional consciousness, not intellectual prison. And the natural state of a ball is to float on the top of a tank of water. To put it in an unnatural state, you have to push the ball down, and not just push the ball down, you have to bloody hold it there, right? And that's what the intellect in isolation is seeking to do, and we're being manipulated through the intellect to do that. We're holding the ball, consciousness, on the bottom of the tank. The choice is not to go with it. The choice is to stop not going with it by taking our hand away. And what happens? The ball goes whoosh, natural state, floating on top of the water. And so we need to, if you like, get the freaking intellect out of the way, and the rest will take care of itself.
Have you got any predictions for the future? I know you've had them in the past.
Predictions for the future. Well, we're changing the future with every thought, but predictions for the future, we are going to see those that wish to control getting more and more desperate and panic-stricken to keep the Orwellian ball rolling against an awakening consciousness. And there's going to come a point where the ball ceases to roll. But it's going to roll for a while yet, because not enough people are awake yet. But, you know, the thing is to stay with it even when things seem lost, because they're not lost. It's just taking, it's just a course of events taking its course. And eventually this will be a paradise, because the consciousness shift is going to happen. When that will take place, my lifetime, I hope.
If you could give people one piece of advice, what would it be?
Realize that the physical world is an illusion, that the physical body is a computer through which you are experiencing this reality, but it's not what you are. I don't care if you're black, white, sky blue, sodding pink. I don't care what part of the world you come from. I don't care what your background is. That is not who you are. It is what you're experiencing. What you are is infinite consciousness. All it is, has been, ever will be. That's who you are. And when you see yourself from that perspective, rather than Alf Jones or Mary Smith, your whole life will change, because you'll realize there is no little me. That's just a figment of the intellect's imagination. There is not even a we. There is only an infinite I, and we are all that I. Everything. Every race, every color, every creed, whether you're a man, whether you're a woman, whether you're a child or an adult, whether you're a tree, a blade of grass, or a breath of air, that's what we are. One infinite I. We are having an experience which gives us the illusion of apartness, which is good, it's a bit of fun, but it's got out of hand because we've lost touch with that level of ourselves that can tell us, hey, it's just an experience. We think the experience is who we are. It ain't. That's how we've been enslaved. To be unenslaved, we have to realize it's all a nonsense. It's an experience. We are infinite consciousness, always have been, always will be. And whether, you know, the Orwellian state takes over here, or whether it becomes paradise, will always be infinite consciousness, whatever happens. And we can choose our experience by our decisions. And we're in control. That's what I'm trying to say here. We're in control. We've just been manipulated to believe that someone else is in control, and therefore we have to give our power away to those that are in control. We need to realize that the power is with us. It always has been. We've just forgotten.
David Icke, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And that's a wrap for our interview with David Icke. Again, thank you to John Smithies for getting us that interview, and for David Icke for appearing on the show. If you want to find out more on his books and research, you can find him at davidicke.com, and we'll have links on mysteriousuniverse.org. Thanks for listening in. This has been the Mysterious Universe podcast, and we'll be returning shortly with our regular episodes.